Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back in Colorado and back in Steamboat Springs. I've only been to Steamboat once previously, and that was to ski, as you can imagine, and I hope to get back at some other time. Let me, if I can, let you know that I'm going to show you some slides. Your organization has copies. Hopefully you can see these, but I would encourage you to try to get a copy online or whatever to take a look at them at your leisure, because there's a lot of powerful information here, and I'm going to make a few points about each one, but I want to save plenty of time for questions because I think that's the most important thing. But I'm going to give you plenty of meat. Let me say at the outset, I'm a political independent, and I have been for the last 14 years. And so the fact of the matter is that I think you'll see that I'll be fact-based, nonpartisan, non-ideological about this issue, and I think it's important to do that because the facts aren't blue or red, but they're very important. Although, actually, they're more red because of the red ink that we have right now. First, personal opinion. Government has grown too big, promised too much, and waited too long to restructure. In 1800, the federal government was 2% of the U.S. economy. Now, the United States was a lot different country in 1800. The world was a lot different place in 1800. But today, the federal government is 25% of the economy, and based upon our current policies and path, it is on track to be 39% of the U.S. economy by 2040 if we don't change course. And if you add state and local government, government would be over 50% of the global economy. As we say in Texas, that dog don't hunt. It's not going to happen. The real question is that when are we going to course correct? And it's important to know government has a legitimate purpose. I am not an anti-government person at all. But as you'll find out, government has expanded far beyond what the framers of the Constitution intended. And we're going to have to decide what's appropriate and what's not going forward. This you'll have to study at your leisure. This is spending per person adjusted for inflation. So you see that since World War II, while we had a decline in spending per person adjusted for inflation, we have been on a march to the northeast quadrant of this graphic for a long time. And you will see we've been particularly out of control in the last 10 years. If it's blue at the bottom, that means the Democrats control both the Senate and the House. If it's red, it means the Republicans control both the Senate and the House. If it's mixed, it means the House and the Senate were split. And at the very top, you can tell which party controlled the White House. Here's the bottom line. Spending is a bipartisan problem. And the last 10 years have been the most fiscally irresponsible years in the history of the United States. And it's a bipartisan problem. And I would argue that fiscal 2003, was arguably the most fiscally irresponsible year in the history of the United States. Three things happened in 2003. And I normally ask the audience to participate here, but it's a fairly large audience, so I'm going to go ahead and cover it. First, we had a second round of tax cuts that we could not afford. We had already returned to deficits. Secondly, we evaded a sovereign nation without declaring war and without paying for it, otherwise known as Iraq. And my son fought as a Marine Corps officer in Iraq. And thirdly, we expanded Medicare to cover prescription drugs, added $8 trillion in new unfunded obligations when Medicare was underfunded by $19 trillion already. Three fiscally irresponsible actions, and frankly, things have gotten worse since. And that was the first year, 2003, was the first year that the statutory budget controls had expired. Now, let me give you a reason why this is not a partisan issue. Let's take President George Herbert Walker Bush, of which I was an appointee, and President William Jefferson Clinton, of which I was a presidential appointee. They did three things in common with regard to fiscal responsibility. First, they supported tough statutory budget controls that constrained spending and prevented the Congress from making more promises when we had already overpromised. Secondly, they did not expand entitlement programs, which is the most imprudent thing that you can do. And thirdly, They both broke campaign promises on taxes when they saw that those promises were irresponsible. 3-0, batting 1,000. One Republican, one Democrat. Fast forward, George Walker Bush, 43, and Barack Obama, 0-3. A strikeout on all three of those points. Now, the difference is President Bush's term is over, and history will have to judge him in time. President Obama's term is not. He can change course. The question is, will he? And I'm very much looking forward to his speech right after Labor Day, because I've been pushing the White House for a while to say that the president needs to, A, be very specific as to what he's proposing the Congress to do to deal with our current weak economic recovery and high unemployment, and secondly, to provide some specific recommendations to the new joint committee who's supposed to try to come up with additional deficit reduction efforts for their consideration as part of their efforts later this year. Hopefully he will, because I think he has not been specific enough to date, and that's critically important. The composition of federal spending has changed dramatically in the last 40 years. 40 years ago, defense dominated the budget. It was 42% of the budget. And in addition, Congress got to decide how over 60% of the budget would be spent every year. In 2010, the last fiscal year that's completed, it's flipped tremendously. First, our budget is dominated by social insurance programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. In addition, rather than Congress having to decide how over 60% of the budget would be spent, it's now below 40. And it's going to be below 20 by 2040 if we don't change course. Now, you might say, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, first, those of you who are students of history and the Constitution, which I try to be, will realize that all of the express and enumerated responsibilities envisioned by the Founding Fathers are in discretionary spending. National defense, homeland security, federal judicial system, executive office of the president, Congress of the United States, I can go on and on. You get the idea. In addition, all of the investments in the future are in discretionary spending. And so what's happening is not just a matter of losing control, it's a matter of expanding government beyond the visions of the founders and cutting investments in our future. In fact, I would respectfully say right now that what I'm going to be talking to you about tonight is not just a fiscal and economic issue. It is a moral issue. Because we are mortgaging the future of our children and grandchildren at record rates. We are reducing investments in their future at a time that they will face increasing competition and an increasingly competitive and interconnected global marketplace. That is not only irresponsible, that is immoral. And normally when I give speeches, not today, tonight, but I'll tell you, the last slide a lot of times I use are my three grandkids, because that's what it's all about to me. 10, 8, and 5. They're too young to vote. They don't have a voice. I'm their voice. So the fact is if we then look at debt, from George Washington to William Jefferson Clinton, we accumulated $5.6 trillion of debt. That's both public debt and debt owed to Social Security, Medicare, and other trust funds. That was about 58% of the economy. In the last 10 years, we've gone from $5.6 trillion to $14.6, almost 100% of the economy, and we are at risk of doubling again within the next 10 to 12 years if we don't change course. And the real issue is not today's deficits, $1 trillion plus, not today's debt, $14.6 trillion. The real problem is what's off the balance sheet. The unfunded obligations for Medicare, for Social Security, a range of commitments and contingencies that as of September 30, 2010, based upon reasonable and sustainable assumptions, amounted to about $62 trillion. Now, let me translate that to numbers that we can understand better. That's about $200,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. No wonder newborn babies cry. That's about 530,000 per household. Believe it or not, median household income in the United States is $50,000. So that means that the typical household has a second or third mortgage equal to 10 times their income. They just don't know it. Now that's on the current path. And what's important is that we change our course. This is why we had to raise the debt ceiling limit. In fiscal 2011, federal revenues are below 15% of the economy, whereas the historical average for the last 30 to 40 years has been 18.2%. Federal spending is 25% of the economy, 24 to 25, when the historical average is 20.5. So revenues are at almost historical lows in modern history, in fact are, and spending is at historical highs in modern history. We are spending for this year, ended September 30, $4 billion a day, every day, including weekends, more than we take in. $1.40 to $1.42 for every dollar that we take in. In addition, if you eliminated all discretionary spending, keep in mind that includes defense, homeland security, education, transportation, the national parks, all these issues and the other things that I talked about. If you eliminated all of it, we're still $2 billion a week short. So therefore, you had to raise the debt ceiling limit. The question is, in exchange for what and how much? And my view was, what was done was modest. We should have done much more. And because it took until less than 12 hours before the Treasury Secretary was going to have to decide which bills are you going to pay and which ones you're not going to pay, and because the deal was modest compared to what S&P, Standard & Poor's, was asking for those two reasons, the dysfunctionality of the political system and the fact that the deal was disappointing, we, for the first time in the history of the United States, were downgraded to AA+. Now, let me take a minute about this. This is very important. The United States will never default on its bonds. Why? Several reasons. Number one, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution guarantees federal bondholders and military pensioners, but it doesn't guarantee anything else. It doesn't guarantee Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, anything else. So bondholders are guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. In addition, the United States can print money, and it issues its debt in its own currency. So it can just print more money. Now, that doesn't solve the problem. It's obviously inflationary. It obviously results in devaluing the currency over time. But the fact is, we're never going to default. However, we have serious interest rate, inflation, and currency risk over time because of our out-of-control fiscal policy, tax and spend, and our, frankly, out-of-control monetary policy. And we can come back to that in the Q&A session if you want. This talk is really more about fiscal policy, which is tax and spend. Now, this is per person, adjusted for inflation, since World War II. The red is spending, the blue is revenues. Here's the bottom line. We are spending at 40 to 50% per person after inflation what we were spending at the height of World War II. We are running deficits per person adjusted for inflation comparable to the level of deficits we ran in World War II. Now, I would respectfully suggest that we got something for World War II. We avoided attack on the continental United States. We defeated the Axis powers. We saved the free world. And after World War II, the United States was over 50% of the global economy. Demographics were working in our favor. And the dollar was as good as gold. So we ended up investing in human capital, the GI Bill. We invested in critical infrastructure, e.g., the National Highway System. We invested in the war-torn nations overseas, including the defeated Axis powers, to stimulate global economic growth and trade. We brought back fiscal responsibility. And even though we didn't pay down a dime of debt until fiscal 2000, debt as a percentage of the economy plummeted because the economy grew and we had fiscal responsibility. And that's what matters, debt as a percentage of the economy. That's what matters. Some debt is okay. Some debt is good. It's investment-oriented. Some is necessary because of a desire to try to save the free world. But not all debt is equal. And now we're about 100% of GDP, rising rapidly. That's clearly imprudent. It's clearly unsustainable on the path that we're on. Now, what about debt per person? Debt per person adjusted for inflation is over double what it was at the end of World War II. And we are adding debt at record rates. And you have to ask yourself, what are we getting for this debt? Keep in mind another thing here. Bless you. There's two kinds of taxes. There's current taxes and there's deferred taxes. And deficits and debt represent deferred taxes that all of us, our children and grandchildren, will have to bear absent a restructuring of government. There's no free lunch. Now, unlike at the end of World War II, where we were the world's largest creditor nation, we lent money to other people. Nobody lent money to us. We lent money to other people. We had no foreign debt, and we were a creditor nation. Today, we're the world's largest debtor nation. About 46% of debt held by the public is held by foreign lenders, China and Japan being the largest two. That is not in our long-term economic, foreign policy, and national security interest. And who is the largest holder of our debt? The Federal Reserve. They own as much of our debt as China and Japan combined. We are self-dealing in our own debt. We're buying our own debt. Why? To stimulate the economy in the short term, to hold down interest rates, to try to help mortgages and the housing market. You can do that for a little while. You can't do that forever. Eventually, you have to unwind that position. And when you unwind that position, then market forces really come to bear. And then you have to see what interest rates will really be when you have a real market-oriented environment. And yes, our interest rates right now are about at historic lows. But who's buying our 10-year and 30-year bonds? Not many people. Why? Because there's huge interest rate risk and currency risk. We can sell short-term debt all we want because we're not going to default on our debt. You're not going to lose principal. It's very liquid. And as you've probably seen, the markets have been kind of volatile lately. And there's not a whole lot of money to be made, you know, in certain other things lately. And so people are of flight to safety. And if you look at us compared to Europe, we look pretty good compared to Europe. But what good does it do to be the best-looking horse in the glue factory? So we need to wake up and recognize that we got a problem. We need to start dealing with it. Now, the Comeback America Initiative partnered with Stanford University's MBA programs and created the first ever Sovereign Fiscal Responsibility Index. It's kind of a fiscal fitness index. It basically ranks 34 countries on fiscal responsibility and sustainability. We're going to do this every year. Number one, Australia, where I'm going to the end of this week to speak to their, you know, to give us some speeches there and talk to their government leaders. Number 34, Greece. We all know that Greece has got problems. I'll come back to that. And where are we? Number 28. We're in a bad neighborhood. We need to move on up. I mean, heck, Mexico's 18. You know, we got countries in here that Americans don't even know are countries. Estonia, you know. I mean, you know, Slovakia. I mean, fortunately, most of us in here know that because we're probably better traveled and better educated than most. Look, we've gone down dramatically. We've gone down dramatically. America should be embarrassed of what our position is, and we need to start doing something about it. Here's the good news. If the Congress and the President could work together and pass fiscal reforms, entitlement reforms, defense and other spending, tax reform, that had the same bottom line impact as the so-called Simpson-Bowles Commission, doesn't have to be the same reforms, but the same bottom line impact, we would go from 28 to 8. We'd have fiscal sustainability for 40 plus years, and we'd be number three in the world in fiscal governance. So what's the problem? The truth is, the biggest deficit that America has is a leadership deficit. And there are... And our politics have been taken over by the wingnuts. And I'll come back to that a little bit later. This is what the future looks like on our current path. The bar represents spending as a percentage of the economy, so inflation's taken out. The green line represents revenues, assuming we go back to historical levels, about 18.2% of GDP. This assumes we don't reform Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, you know, that defense and other spending grows at the rate of the economy, so it doesn't get any bigger as a percentage of the economy, it doesn't get any smaller, and that we just charge the credit card. You know, and what happens? The largest expense the federal government has in 2046 is interest. It's actually before that. And the only thing we can pay with 18.2% of GDP is interest. Nothing else. Well, you know, as I said, that dog don't hunt. And government keeps two sets of books. At least. We have the Congressional Budget Office. They're nonpartisan. They do a great job. The problem is they have to do their work with handcuffs on and one arm tied behind their back. I guess kind of like this. I don't know. But the fact is that, you know, they have to assume that if Congress says that they're going to do something, that they'll actually do it. Like all the Bush-Obama tax cuts, now they're Bush-Obama, tax cuts are going to expire. Like that we're really going to cut back on payments to physicians like 20 to 30% all at once. Those are two prominent examples. So they have to assume that. So when they end up making these unreasonable assumptions, then you get the blue. That's debt to GDP in the blue. But when you make it more realistic about what's more likely to happen, you get the red. And what does that mean? Third world nation status for the United States on debt to GDP. Third world nation status. Healthcare. Well, we have the Affordable Care Act. I don't call it by other names because I don't like to personalize, okay? The Affordable Care Act, okay? And the fact is that there is no debate that total healthcare costs for the federal government will go up. Why? Because you can't reduce costs by expanding coverage. It's an oxymoron. 32 million more people will get coverage. That's a good thing. But it's going to cost more money. And this was a coverage expansion bill. It wasn't a healthcare cost bill. The problem with that is we had already made way more promises than we can afford. We have a wimpy fiscal policy. That's like Popeye, you know, wimpy. I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. In government, I'll gladly make the tough decisions on Tuesday. Just let me do more of what I want to do today. But Tuesday never comes. In this case, there is a debate about whether or not the health care bill will reduce the deficit or increase it and help or hurt our debt situation long term. In my opinion, to answer that question, you have to say, would you rather believe the professionals or the politicians? Well, I'm a certified public accountant, so I'm a professional, and I have professional standards that I have to operate with, and so do actuaries. And I would turn to the chief actuary of Medicare, who also has professional standards, who for 2 years in a row has given an adverse opinion on Medicare trustees' reports, 2 years in a row, unprecedented, saying that the assumptions are unreasonable, unsustainable. They're basically the ones that CBO had to use, came up with a separate estimate of the impact on Medicare alone that was, stand by, $12 trillion higher in current dollars. And as we say for accounting, that's material. So it's a problem. Now here's revenues per person adjusted for inflation. And you can see they've been going up, not as fast as spending, but when you study this carefully, you'll see not all tax cuts stimulate the economy, and not all tax cuts pay for themselves. There's only two types of tax cuts that have been proven over time to have the potential to pay for themselves. Now, what do I mean by that? That means that you generate more revenues after the tax cut than you would have had you not done it. Understand, just because revenues go up doesn't mean the tax cut paid for itself, because revenues will go up because of economic growth, because of inflation, and because of bracket creep. So you have to say what happened versus what would have happened. Now, there's two kinds generally that have proven over time that can do that. Number one, dramatic reductions in top marginal tax rates, like during Kennedy's time. You know, at one point in time, we used to have 90% marginal tax rates. Now we're 35. How low can you go? The second one is dramatic reductions in tariffs. Well, you know, the federal government used to be funded by tariffs before 1913, largely when the income tax came in. But now it's not, and we have free trade zones. So the fact of the matter is a lot of our policies are based upon outdated concepts, both our spending and our tax policies, and we need to rethink them. Now, we do have a progressive tax system. By that I mean, this is a graphic that shows total tax burden. Well, that means income taxes and, this is federal taxes, income taxes and payroll taxes. So Social Security, Medicare, FICA tax, okay? The top 20% of earners pay 68% of all taxes. The top 0.1% pay 11% of all taxes. So it's progressive. We can debate whether it's progressive enough, but it is progressive. It's a fact. Here's the problem. We have a problem on both ends. That's why you can't go by averages. These are based on medians. 51% of Americans pay zippo in income tax. Zippo. And a significant percentage get rebates through the Earned Income Tax Credit. Now, these people pay payroll taxes, but keep in mind what I said before. The income tax funds all or substantially all the constitutional roles of the federal government. When you have 51% of the population getting a free ride on the constitutional roles of the federal government in a democracy, that is a dangerous disconnect. Now, obviously, those who are truly poor should be relieved, but at some point in time, when you make a certain function of the poverty level, you need to pay some income tax. So we have a problem on the lower end. We have a problem on the upper end. The median effective tax rate for the top 1% of Americans is 18.8%. Well, now, I'm not in the top 1%, and I pay a heck of a lot higher than that. Why? How can that be? The top marginal tax rate is 35% because truly wealthy people make most of their income in capital gains, and that's taxed at 15%. And so the truth is that when we end up engaging comprehensive tax reform, which we need to, and I'll talk some about that in a few minutes, you got to address the bottom and the top through comprehensive tax reform, and I'll talk about that. Now, what about states? Keep in mind, bad news flows downhill. When the federal government starts restructuring, the states are going to feel it, then the locality is going to feel it. Keep in mind, the typical state relies upon the federal government for 35 to 42% of its revenues, and then localities rely on revenues from the state. So bad news flows downhill. So before the bad news has started flowing downhill, this is the financial status of states. This is the total liabilities and unfunded promises per household for the 50 states. Number one, Wyoming. Number 50, where I live, unfortunately, Connecticut. I should have read this before I moved. And number 16, Colorado. So you're in relatively good shape. So congratulations, Colorado, but maybe you can move up and get a medal later. These are the systemic challenges facing all levels of government. I'm confident that everybody here can read as well as I can, so I'm not going to read these. But we have certain systemic challenges that face all levels of government that have to be addressed. And we also need to be working together to a greater extent to deal with common challenges in a coordinated fashion, because we're all in the same boat, and we need to recognize that reality. I'm not going to cover all of these. Now, let me tell you where we're at. Our financial condition is worse than advertised. We face large and growing structural deficits. We are headed for a fiscal cliff at breakneck speed. We need to change course. How many of you have seen Thelma and Louise? Please raise your hand. It's a cult film. All right. Remember at the end of Thelma and Louise, they go over the cliff and everybody cheers. Well, we're headed for a fiscal cliff in a Government Motors Corporation convertible Cadillac. Remember, the government took over GM. And if we go over that cliff, people aren't going to be cheering. Now, what do we need to do? First, you have to recognize you got a problem and that doing nothing is not an option. You also have to recognize you can't grow your way out of the problem. Yes, we want to stimulate economic growth. We want to be pro-growth. But there's a new four-letter word. It's called math. You would have to grow at double-digit real GDP for decades to grow out of our hole. It's never happened. It's not going to happen. In fact, on our current policies, we're going to have slower economic growth, not faster economic growth. So, first, you can't grow your way. Number two, we can't inflate our way out. Why? Because inflation reduces the burdens of the current $14.6 trillion in debt. But the problem's not the $14.6 trillion in debt. It's the difference between the 14.6 and the 62 that are off the balance sheet, which, by the way, are driven by demographics and healthcare costs, which grow faster than inflation and faster than the economy when the economy grows. So you can't grow your way out. You can't just tax your way out. Why? You would have to double federal taxes by 2035 to 2040. Americans will not allow that. And obviously it would be a significant adverse effect on economic growth and our competitive posture. You can't cut your way out. You would have just cut your way out. You would have to decimate the social safety net and a whole range of others. So what do you have to do? Everything's got to be on the table. Everybody's got to be at the table. In my view, our problem is primarily a spending problem. It is primarily that we've grown too big, promised too much, waited too long to restructure, okay? But understand this. Washington uses words that don't mean the same thing as Webster's Dictionary. And let me give you two examples. When Washington says cut, they mean reduce the rate of increase. According to Webster's, cut is an absolute reduction. Rather than a reduce the rate of increase. Secondly, Washington used the terms trust funds, especially for things like Social Security and Medicare. The problem is you can't trust them. They're not funded. And in fact, if you treated the trust funds of the federal government the same way as a trustee of a private sector pension or retiree health plan, and I used to be Assistant Secretary of Labor for ERISA, so I had oversight of all of that, you'd be in jail. You'd be wearing wide striped suits. So we have to recognize you got to be careful with the words that are used to really understand what they mean. Now, I would respectfully suggest, with everything on the table, to get something done, they have to meet six tests. Sorry, I need an extra pinky. Six tests. They got to make economic sense. They have to be socially equitable. They need to be culturally acceptable. They need to pass a math test. If you're trying to balance the budget or stabilize debt to GDP, the math has got to work based upon reasonable and sustainable assumptions. They have to be politically feasible. What do I mean by that? You've got to pass the House, 60 votes in the Senate, and presidential signature. And if you don't have that, you got nothing but rhetoric. And they need to be able to achieve bipartisan support, because if you pass something on a straight party line vote, like the health care bill, it's not sustainable. My personal view, it's probably going to be struck down as unconstitutional, but whether it is or it isn't, it's not sustainable. It was a straight party line vote, plus we've overpromised. Now, don't get me wrong, as you'll hear me say in a few minutes, we need universal health care, but very different than where we're headed right now. So what do we need to do? And these are examples. And by the way, let me give you our website, www.tcaii.org. You'll see it again here later. There is a new report on there called Restoring Fiscal Sanity. It provides a clear, compelling, concise case about where we are and what do we need to do to restore fiscal sanity. These are the top line items under different categories. We have to reimpose pay-as-you-go rules so you can't end up making more promises under government programs or to cut more taxes if it's going to make our fiscal situation worse. We had them from the 90s through 2002. They expired. We've been out of control. You need spending caps on every major area of the budget, annual spending caps, except for two. Number one, Social Security, because we can reform it and make the numbers work so you don't need a cap. You know roughly what you're going to pay. And interest, because you can't have one. You got to pay what the market says you got to pay. But on everything else, including health care, you got to have a budget. Do you realize we're the only major industrialized nation that doesn't have a budget for health care? Nobody else is dumb enough to write a blank check for health care. Even countries that have socialized medicine cradle to grave, which I'm not advocating, like Sweden, they don't do that because they know it'll bankrupt their country. We can't do it either. We need to also have debt-to-GDP targets that are reasonable and sustainable, that will take us, first, that will get us to stabilize the debt, then decline it, then stabilize it with automatic enforcement mechanisms, automatic spending cuts, and probably 3-to-1 to temporary revenue surcharges to make sure that if they do nothing, which they're good at Washington, things will happen that will be transparent, facilitate accountability, that will keep us from going over the cliff. Social Security, easy. Easy. Seniors think they're going to get taken advantage of. I could use other words, but I won't. Young people think they're going to get the shaft. They're going to get nothing. They're both wrong. Because the truth is that we can make changes that leaves current seniors largely unaffected. You can take people 55 to 60 and leave them largely unaffected. I say it largely with a couple of exceptions. One, changing the basis for calculating inflation for seniors because consumption patterns are different for seniors than they are other parts, and so we ought to make it more reflective of consumption for seniors. And secondly, if seniors are still working or if they're over the age, then we may do something about the taxable wage base cap to raise it but not eliminate it, maybe from $106,800 to $150,000. We need to gradually increase the normal and the early retirement ages. I'd say 2 years over 20 to 30 years, gradually increase it, and then index it to life expectancy after that. Let's keep in mind, the first social insurance program in the Western world was Germany by a brilliant politician, Otto von Bismarck. What did he do? He promised that anybody that lived to 65 would get a modest pension when average life expectancy was 55. So he made a liberal promise that was fiscally responsible. Unfortunately, 1935, we picked 65, even though life expectancy was close to 65, and now it's supposed to go up to 67, but life expectancy has gone way longer than that. So we need to gradually increase it, then index it to life expectancy. We need to modify the benefit formula for people that are near the poverty level, somewhat higher replacement rate. For people that are middle and upper income, somewhat less, but not make it a means-tested program, which turns it into a welfare program. And as I said, we may have to raise the taxable wage base. And I would also say we have to think about having a supplemental savings account on top. You can do these kinds of things. You'll make it solvent, sustainable, secure forever and never have to come back. You know, it's only underfunded $8 to $9 trillion. Medicare's 37 and growing. So what about health care? Well, first, we've way overpromised on health care. And in the Affordable Care Act, there's a provision that actually doesn't deal with health care. It deals with disability called the CLASS Act, which needs to be repealed. It is a huge unfunded provision that we cannot afford and sustain. Now, assuming that the Affordable Care Act is not struck down as unconstitutional or not repealed, then at a minimum what we need to do is to recognize that the Affordable Care Act has way too generous of subsidies for people who are well off. You know, government tends to want to subsidize a lot of people, including people who are well off. Believe it or not, in Medicare, there's three programs. There's Medicare Part A, mandatory, funded with a payroll tax. And then there's B and D, supplemental medical insurance, outpatient, and prescription drugs. Those are voluntary programs. You don't have to sign up for them. Now, 95% of people do. Why? Because the taxpayers pay 75% of the cost. The premium only pays 25%. And if you're running deficits, who's going to pay the 75%? Our children and our grandchildren with interest. It's one thing to provide a 75% subsidy for people who are near the poverty level. I understand that. It's another thing to provide a 75% subsidy for people who are well off. It makes no sense. It threatens the program. So we have to have more means testing of premiums, you know, based upon ability to pay. And we need to do the same thing with regard to the Affordable Care Act, with regard to the new expansion of health care. We have to change our payment system. Right now we pay for what's done rather than what's accomplished. We have to pay. You know, the more you do, the more you get paid. The more you do, the less chance you're going to get sued because you didn't do something you could do. We have to pay more for outcomes. We have to have a more integrated approach to health care. We have to change our malpractice system to take it out of jury trials, to have special courts for health care. And we have to be able to provide evidence-based medical practices that if physicians practice in accordance with those practices, it's a safe harbor against litigation. And that's determined by evidence-based, by physicians, if you will. And we also... Very importantly, we have to rationalize our health care promises. We've way overpromised. I believe in universal health care, but I believe in universal health care that is appropriate, affordable, and sustainable. And I would respectfully suggest that's preventative and wellness, along with catastrophic for everybody, with more for the poor, obviously. But that's what we have to go to over time, phased in over time. And then I've already talked about reducing taxpayer subsidies for high-income individuals. Defense. The United States spends more on defense than the next 14 nations combined. I was on the Defense Business Board as an ex officio member for 8.5 members. There is huge waste in defense. Believe it or not, in the defense planning, by law, the Defense Department is not allowed to consider affordability and sustainability when they're coming up with their quote-unquote requirements, which in Webster's would mean wish list. So as a result, what happens is people come up with all these kinds of things that they want, you know, whether it's weapon systems or technologies or bases or size of force or whatever. They come up with all these things they want, but we can't afford and we can't sustain. We've still got way too much of an overseas presence. We've got a situation where our acquisition and contracting practices result in tens of billions of waste each year because of how they're designed. We've got a situation where the average annual income for a member of the active duty military, current and deferred income, is 2.5 times median household compensation. 2.5 times. We're going to have to restructure. And the last thing, last but by no means least, the Pentagon is a bloated bureaucracy. And it's not just the building that's the Pentagon. I remember that when I was Comptroller General and on the Defense Business Board, I said, well, you know, how much of an effort is it to try to be able to activate and deploy Guard and Reservists to go overseas? Because, you know, we're using the Guard and Reserve for things that we weren't supposed to use the Guard and Reserve for. I mean, they become an extension of the regular force. 24 different units in the Pentagon had to sign off for activating, I think it was 20 or more, Guard or Reservists. Sign off, not FYI, sign off. Can you imagine how many paper pushers and pencil pushers and computers are there dealing with something that's absolutely ridiculous? So, you know, we need to deal with that. We need to deal with the bloated bureaucracy and the overhead in the Defense Department. And we also may have to reconsider whether the all-volunteer force is sustainable. I'm not for the draft, but I think we have to think seriously about national service and whether or not the military would be one option. Most other industrialized nations do. Other spending. There's lots of opportunities to look there. I do think that we ought to take discretionary spending back to 2008 levels, adjusted for inflation, over several years. That's really a cut, because you have to keep in mind that spending increased 20% between 2000, over 20% between 2008 and 2010, and over 30% between 2007 and 2010, and all that can't be justified. But I also believe that we need to make some investments to try to help to prevent a double dip recession, to try to deal with some critical infrastructure needs, and so this framework provides $500 billion in additional investment over 2 years to try to accomplish some objectives, but it's coupled with a clear, credible, and concrete plan to deal with the true threat, which are the longer-term deficits. You can't just deal with the short-term. You must also deal with the structural. And that's, I hope that's what the president will come out with, a short-term proposal and a structural proposal, because we can't just deal with the short-term. We've got to deal with the structural. The long-term is here. It is here. Now, on revenues, we need to engage in comprehensive tax reform that will make it simpler, fairer, more equitable, more competitive, and generate adequate revenues to pay our bills and deliver on the promises that we intend to keep, and allow us to be able to get a debt-to-GDP level that is reasonable and sustainable and doesn't unduly mortgage our kids' and grandkids' future. What I propose under this as a framework is to engage comprehensive tax reform that will eliminate, consolidate, and better target existing deductions, exemptions, credits, and exclusions. That will, so a lot more will be subject to tax, but the top tax rate would go down to 25% for individuals, for corporations, and for the estate tax, 25%. For individuals, there would be a lower rate for lower income, but the top rate would be 25%. And to eliminate the difference between capital gains and ordinary income. If you can get the top tax rate down to 25%, top economists tell me, including former chairman of the Federal Reserve, there's no compelling reason to have a difference of 15 to 25 for long-term capital gains if you can get the top tax rate down to 25%. We need to obviously do something with regard to charitable contributions. I believe you get full deduction for charitable contributions. Why? Because we're going to need to encourage more of them. Because government's overpromised. And therefore, the charitable sector is going to have to do more as government restructures. Secondly, home mortgages. We need to rationalize the home mortgage deduction. Right now, you get two. I would respectfully suggest two is a want, one is a need. So you get it for one. And right now, you get it for up to $1 million. Where'd $1 million come from? Nice round number. But $1 million here is not the same as Peoria, is not the same as New York City. So I'd respectfully suggest that you go with the maximum conforming loan, which varies by affordability, which varies by geographic region, but nowhere in the country is $1 million. And then thirdly, pension and savings. We need to be able to provide incentives for pension and savings, but we need to eliminate a lot of the loopholes where people can end up taking all this money out before retirement and therefore become more reliant on government. And we need to integrate a lot of these preferences in order to make sure that we that they're rational and that there are reasonable limits associated with them. Now that's, and then I think we can also consider, corporations, allow deductibility for dividends for several reasons. One, eliminate double taxation. Number two, corporations have trillions of dollars hanging up on their balance sheet. Trillions. They should either invest them for growth and jobs or distribute them for growth and jobs. And therefore, if they got a deduction for dividends, there would be tremendous shareholder pressure for them to distribute unless they can demonstrate that they can invest them for growth and shareholder return. And that's what you have board of directors for. Board of directors should be there to try to help make that decision about how much should be distributed, how much should be retained. We also have to look at the offshore earnings and whether or not we can get some onshore in order with a commitment for investment in growth in jobs, not the kind of deal that we did on TARP where money went out the door. There were no commitments for anything, and we got the shaft, I can tell you. All right, now I'm not going to go through all of these in detail, but that's kind of a framework that I think should meet those six tests if we had some leadership and if the wing nuts weren't in charge. All right? But the truth is we have to think about Plan B. Because either we're going to restructure our finances or the markets are going to force us to restructure our finances at some point. And if the markets force us to restructure our finances at some point, we're going to have to do a lot more dramatic things a lot quicker. And in Social Security, you're going to have to affect more people. You're going to have to increase the retirement age a lot quicker. you're going to have to think about raising the taxable wage base a lot quicker. In health care, you're going to have to think about repealing the Affordable Care Act in its entirety, accelerate the increase in Medicare eligibility age, accelerate efforts to try to move to more means-tested premiums, and to delay moving to a universal health care system for basic, essential, and catastrophic. For defense, you're going to have to withdraw much quicker out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Under the first one, it's 2014. Under this one, much quicker. And you're ultimately going to have to accelerate the rationalization of defense spending much quicker, and obviously at some higher level of risk by doing that. You're going to have to also accelerate changes and the lower spending caps and other spending. We would also have to, I would argue, immediately repeal some of the tax cuts and potentially consider some type of a temporary deficit reduction surcharge to balance the budget quickly. Because under this scenario, promises won't matter. It'll be show me time. And show me time will say you got to get a balanced budget quick. Now, under this, under the first scenario, I'm going to come to this. Deficits, the budget is balanced for everything but interest by 2014 and for every year thereafter. Debt to GDP goes down dramatically. Under the second one, the entire budget is balanced by 2015 and for most years thereafter, and debt to GDP declines dramatically. I forgot to talk about one thing on taxes. Very important. I don't want to miss this. There's a great debate today about what is a tax increase. There's a great debate. Understand this. The average level of taxation for the last 30 to 40 years has been 18.2% of GDP. We are scheduled under current law. Current law means the Bush-Obama tax cuts expire at the end of 2012, and AMT, alternative minimum tax, is not fixed, among other things. We are scheduled to go to federal revenues of 23.3% of GDP and rising in 2035 versus the historical average of 18.2. In my view, that's too high. So what this proposal does, it follows current law until it gets to 21.5%, and it says, that's it, government gets no more. So then all of a sudden, government's got to say, oh, wait a minute. I got budgets in all my major categories but two. I've got debt to GDP targets with automatic enforcement mechanisms, and I can only have 21.5% of GDP. And then for the first time in government's life since 1789, it's going to have to say, what should we really be doing? What's working? What's not working? How are we going to end up getting the best return for the amount of resources that we have? Because right now, there's no limit to the spigot. And there's also no limit to how much we're mortgaging the future of our children, grandchildren, and others. And by the way, as we look to the future, we have to ask some management 101 questions, which have never been asked and answered in government, ever. These are some of the management 101 questions that we need to ask about every major government department, spending program, and tax preference. And the other thing we need to do is we need a plan. Believe it or not, the U.S. government's been in existence since 1789. It has no future-focused, trend-based, threat, risk, opportunity-based, resource-constrained, outcome-based plan. It's got nothing. Nothing. If you don't have a plan, all you have is prayer. Don't get me wrong, I'm for prayer. But I want prayer and a plan. Now I'm practicing what I preach. When I was Comptroller General of the United States, I'm about done. When I was Comptroller General of the United States, I came into the GAO, been in existence since 1921. It was the leader in performance and accountability, allegedly. It had no plan. It had the same problem. We put one in place. We cut the size of the agency on headcount by 9%. We reduced a number of we eliminated a number of offices. We eliminated a layer of management. We leveraged technology. We focused on outcomes. And after 9.5 years, we were 9% smaller, 50% or more productive, and 2 to 3 times the outcomes. If it can be done there, it can be done anywhere. But you need leadership. And you need to follow management 101 principles. In summary, we live in a great country, but we're not as great as we think we are. We have strayed from the principles and values that made us great. We have lost our way. We need to come back to those principles and values so that our future can be better than our past, so that America can stay great, and so that our children, grandchildren, and future generations will have as much or more opportunity than we have. Yes, we can, no pun intended. Yes, we can avoid a debt crisis, make tough choices, and help to ensure that our future is better than our past. But for that to happen, the first three words in the Constitution have to come alive. Now, this is audience participation. What are they? We the people are responsible and accountable for what does or not does not happen. We must not tolerate this nonsense anymore. We can't run our families this way. You can't run a business this way. You can't run a country this way. And what we have to do is to recognize that elected officials need to be able to demonstrate they're serious about this. They need to be able to have a plan or otherwise endorse a plan. They need to start making progress. And if they don't, I don't care if they're Democrat, Republican, or Independent, get rid of them. Get rid of them. The truth is we need policy reforms and we need political reforms. We need redistricting reform. We need integrated and open primaries, and I'm happy to answer questions on this. We need campaign finance reform, especially in light of the two recent Supreme Court decisions. And in my opinion, there are pros and cons. We need 12 to 18-year term limits. With that, I'm happy to answer your questions. Thank you.